Now entering the truth zone, deep into the vortex of the information revolution, with your host, Michael B.
My name is Michael B., and this is The Truth Zone. And on this partly cloudy Monday morning in North Dallas, Texas, June 5th, 2017, I come to you deep within the vortex of the information revolution. Today I'm going to cover two topics. One is a particular Bible verse from the first book, Genesis, chapter 3, verse 22. Now, New Age people, as I call them, are fascinated with this verse in conjunction with basically the elitist and the New World Order, which I know many people think doesn't exist, but it does exist. And so I had this discussion with this woman, a friend of my wife's and mine, and she was very passionate about it, to the point where when I tried to interject on what I thought, I was met with, I would say, not hostility, but with a pushback, for certain. Because she was deeply, deeply convinced that she was right, and that Genesis chapter 3 was the story of the creation of man, and man's fight for immortality, and that it was taken away by several gods, which my Bible understanding and my understanding of Judeo-Christianity, that's not exactly the case. First of all, chapter 3 in Genesis was not about man's creation. Man and woman was already created. Now, we don't know how much time went by. We don't know if it was a literal Adam and Eve per se. You have to remember that in that time, names and concepts were synonymous. Adam means man, and Eve means woman. So in the sense of man and woman, it could be mankind and womankind. It could be, you know, it could be an allegory for Lucifer's involvement with mankind and having him and her turn away from the Lord, which then has led to, well, basically where we are in 2017. And I want to get into that because people out there are of the understanding that we have a gene that's been shut off, and that we can be immortal. And the world elites talk about this immortality, which really what they want to do is fuse us with machines, but not us. See, we're not part of that exclusive club. It's their club, and as George Carlin said, we're not in it. So, I don't think there's any scientific evidence that says that we can live forever. Certainly, there is scientific evidence, which, by the way, Genesis chapter 6 talks about thousands of years ago, written by Moses, that the human body, disease-free, can last up to 120 years. And that has been proven, I don't know exactly when, I'm going to say within 50 years, let's just say, that exactly that, disease-free, the body can last 120 years. And you can look that up. Either last month or the month before that, the last person to be born in the 19th century died in Italy. She was 117. She almost made it to the max. So this immortality gene thing, you know, the New Age people want to believe that we can obtain that through higher frequencies and energy and things of that nature. So she was quite convinced that multiple gods ruled the world, and that in Genesis chapter 3, verse 22, they took away our immortality out of basically, she put on a posture where the gods were arrogantly saying, no, you're not going to be like us, which the Bible does not portray that. Now, chapter 3, again, has nothing to do with creation. It has to do with the fall of man. And so we see that Lucifer comes in, and I played an audio clip, a few weeks ago when I first started on my five-part series of Islam, where there is now archaeological proof that actually there were four-legged serpents thousands of years ago that devolved into the snakes we see today, thus fulfilling the biblical writing of Moses. So, the fall, let's set the stage. Man and woman, they're going about their business. Everything is lovely. Lucifer walks in and says, so, is it true that you cannot eat off of that tree? And if you do, you will die. And Eve said, yes, that is true. We could eat from all of the trees of the garden except that one, or we will die. Satan says to Eve, that is not true. If you eat from that tree, you'll know good from evil, and you will be like God. So Eve said, gee, I'll take a shot at it. And she ate. She also gave to Adam. And the way the Bible is written, it's almost like Adam was unaware of where the fruit came from. So he goes, all right, well, hey, my wife has given me a piece of fruit. I'll eat it. I mean, that fruit could have been anything. It doesn't even have to be literal fruit. Again, this is most likely an allegory given to the people to show how man fell from grace. So Adam eats it. Their eyes are opened. They realize that they're naked. The rose-colored glasses deal, I guess, is off. And so now God decides to walk through the garden, and he's calling on Adam and Eve. They hide because they were naked, and God got outraged that they ate from the forbidden tree. He curses Satan, says, in the form of a serpent, you will now slink on the ground, if you will. You're the most cursed among the wild animals. Eve is going to have pain in child labor, and man is going to have to sweat and toil the fields and really not have a good time, right? So, and then God made clothes for Adam and Eve. Now, this is where it gets interesting. This is where the New World Order, and it's true, if you look at their symbols, they have 322 on a lot of their symbols. And they've taken this to mean that this was their opportunity to become like God, and God took it away, putting God in a bad light as if he's depriving man of something. And I personally, you know, I struggled with this for over 20 years because I asked myself that question as well. Why wouldn't God want us to be like him? Why wouldn't God want us to have God-like insight and power and all sorts of that good stuff? Why would he take that away from us? Why would he block the Garden of Eden? And it took me over 20 years to realize it. And it was staring in my face the entire time. There's a quote that says, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, see, that's the point. God removed Adam and Eve from the garden because man can no longer be trusted any longer not to disobey. And man cannot handle absolute power. Are we not seeing that with the New World Order, with this push for one world government? Look at the pain, blues, and sorrow that the George Soroses of the world are inflicting on all of us. Man is not capable of handling such power. And certainly, many of the angels weren't. Lucifer wasn't. He let jealousy and he wanted to be worshipped like God take out his station. He was an archangel. There's only three archangels mentioned in the Judeo-Christian Bible. That's Michael, Gabriel, and Lucifer, who later then became Satan, the devil, the father of the lie, the rebel, the resistor. That's it. Those are the only three mentioned in the Jewish and Christian scriptures. So he couldn't even handle his station. All the other angels that you hear the story of the Nephilim or the Titans in Greek literature, the giants that even angels in heaven got tempted, took human form, and took on human women, the best ones, the most beautiful ones, as wives, and created this hybrid angelic human existence, which the flood tells us that all got wiped out. And again, whether these are literal stories, which is evidence that a great flood did take place, and that a human remnant was saved, and that's a whole other show. So we're not going to get into that. But we get into the verse 22, the key one. So Lord God said, the man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also, so there's two trees, also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. Exactly. Because God knew and knows that man cannot handle absolute power. We can't handle absolute power on the human level. Could you imagine now if we became literally godlike? Probably we would have destroyed ourselves already. So now the question becomes like one of us. Us we know is plural. Who is God talking to? Now, as a Christian, as it says in the Bible, Jesus Christ is God's first creation. Even before the earth, even before the universe as we know it. Christ was created first. And then through him, all things were created. So we can say that there was a co-creation taking place. Now, the woman I was speaking with, her origin is the Jewish faith. So of course, she does not believe that Christ is God's son and the whole Christian scriptures deal. So she would not accept the fact that God's name is Jehovah, which means I am who I shall prove to be. And I don't think she also understands that, again, as I said, names and concepts were synonymous. So it is true that before Moses and the burning bush story, the term Yahweh or Jehovah, I am who I shall prove to be, was not used. That is correct. The Jews were using the word Elohim, which is plural for Eloi or El. And basically what that means, Elohim is a source of strength or power or effect. Elohim is the infinite, all-powerful God who shows by his works that he is the creator, sustainer, and supreme judge of the world. As it says in Psalm 7, verse 9, bring to an end the violence of the wicked and make the righteous secure. You, the righteous, Elohim, who probes minds and hearts. And I'm getting this from gotquestions.org, meaning of Elohim. Sometimes the word Elohim is shortened to El and used as part of a longer name. El Shaddai, for example, means God Almighty, Genesis 49:24. Elyon means God Most High, Deuteronomy 26:19. And El Roy means God who sees, Genesis 16:13. Personal names of people can include the name of God. Daniel, El, is my judge. Nathaniel, gift of El. Samuel, heard by El. Elijah, El is Yahweh. And Ariel, lioness of El, are examples. Place names, too, can contain the shortened form of Elohim. Bethel, house of El. Jezreel, El will sow. And, of course, Israel, prince of El, are examples. When Jesus cried out from the cross, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, Mark 15:34, he addressed the Father with a form of Elohim, Eloi. Mark translates Jesus' statement for us, my God, why have you forsaken me? So, there are not multiple gods here, as pagans and anti-Christians would have you believe in verse 322. Jehovah, Elohim, at that point, is speaking to his heavenly court. We cannot have man be like us and live forever and have God-like powers, because man cannot handle such power. But the Antichrist energy, the Luciferians, by another name, would like to skew verse 322 in Genesis and say that God robbed man of his immortality and his superiority. That was not the case. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that it was a lock that man was going to live forever once born. Wasn't in there. That actually Adam and Eve would have had to have eaten from the tree of life to obtain that immortality. So it is reasonable to conclude that most likely, like the animals, man was due to expire at some point in his earthly life, and perhaps return to heaven, and that's a whole other discussion of where does our consciousness go after our earthly bodies decay and we expire. That's a whole other deal. So that's where Genesis 3:22 comes in, and the New World Order crowd, the Luciferians, the Satanists, and that's just what they are, the Antichrist energy, wants you to believe that God took away your right to immortality and your right to supernatural powers. And he did that out of some control lust and some arrogant tone of, you know, you're not going to be like one of us. God is a loving God and doesn't want us to suffer. And indeed, if we would just listen to his word, which is in the Bible from Genesis to Jude, and I don't count Revelation because Revelation is more of a warning. It obviously means apocalypse or Armageddon, a great ending. It really is a warning for what will happen to us if we don't follow his word. It's not really that much of doctrine or a guidepost for living as the rest of the book, the rest of the collection of books. So that's how that works on Genesis 3:22. Do not be fooled and do not be deceived. As it says at the end of Revelation, whoever takes away from this word or adds to this word will suffer a very, very big punishment. So, I urge all of you to not be fooled by Genesis 3:22 and get involved in all that reptilian, alien, hybrid, underground business. Because it's either that, and there really has been no evidence of that, or we can say all this UFO business or whatnot is either DARPA, that secret, not so secret now, clandestine part of the military industrial complex that comes up with our futuristic technology, and they've got stuff, obviously, that we don't even know about. And a lot of these so-called alien abductions, the other side of the argument is that these are government people within DARPA and other black ops actually kidnapping people from around the world, mostly, obviously, in remote places, out in the country or the woods or what have you, which makes sense. You don't want to start abducting people in New York City. That would gain more attention as opposed to the wild lands of North Dakota and Montana, let's say. Or the desert of Arizona, let's say. Or if you want to stay in the supernatural realm, you could say that these are the fallen angels deceiving us. Because as we know, the Archangel Michael drove out Satan and his legion, and well, they landed on the lower realms of heaven. There are several realms of heaven. Paul talks about that, and the lowest realm of heaven is directly above the earth. And so we can get into, you know, who's the ruler of this world. 1 John 5:19, the world lies in the power of the wicked one. Satan was able to tempt Jesus with all the governments of the world. All the kingdoms would be at your feet if you do obeisance to me. Well, how did he get that power? And why? Well, you can look at the book of Job. Why did God allow Satan to persecute Job, take everything from him, and make him suffer? And again, do these have to be literal stories? No, they could be allegories. But it's allegories of a test. That, you know, yeah, you can worship God and Jesus and love up on them all you want when things are going great. But what are you going to do in times of tribulation? Are you going to curse God and blame him for everything, as that's what atheists have done, the Karl Marxes of the world? Or are you going to hold fast like Job and ask for God's favor and have faith that no matter what happens in this human episode, that there is something better waiting for me when I expire? See, that's the test. It's just like, I think it's in Matthew, maybe even in all the Gospels, when it talks about, you know, love your enemy. Oh, it's so easy to love your friends. I mean, the taxpayers love their friends and family too. But how are you different than the taxpayer? How are you different than the idolater? Or the extortionist? Or the murderer? How are you different? Right? Jesus tells you to be kind to your enemy. It's like dumping hot coals upon their head, as opposed to repaying evil for evil. So that's the difference. So that is the ultimate test. That in trials and tribulation, who are you going to curse, or who are you going to turn to? So that's where 3:22 comes in. Now, the continuation of that discussion, again, I was speaking with a Jewish woman who started to bring up the historical validity of Jesus Christ. And I wanted to say, well, we could get into that. Let me have your email. I've got stuff for you. Nope, that's okay. See, she didn't want to hear it. She didn't want to read it, because I was ready to go. And unfortunately, I cannot find where I put that collection into a Word doc. It's on one of my many computers. I'll find it, but right now I can't. But before the show, I was able to Google, and I found biblicalarchaeology.org. Did Jesus exist? searching for evidence beyond the Bible. And actually, in the collection I had, there's actually more historical data, more local historians of that time wrote about Jesus Christ than they wrote about Julius Caesar. Yet everybody accepts Julius Caesar. Well, that comes as no surprise, does it? Because when you go to a secular school, well, Julius Caesar, I imagine, it's been a long time since I've been in school, that the Roman Empire is still taught. And Julius Caesar is still spoken about. So, yeah, of course. And of course, we have the separation of church and state nonsense, which I blew out of the water Friday. Jesus Christ isn't taught in school. So, if you don't have parents taking you to Sunday school or teaching you about Jesus himself, you're not going to know that other historians like Tacitus and Josephus wrote about Jesus Christ, that it wasn't just the Gospels. So, getting into this article a little bit, this is coming from Lawrence McTikiuk's feature article in January, February 2015. After two decades toiling in the quiet groves of academia, I published an article in BAR, and I'm not quite sure what B-A-R is. Maybe that's some organization, not sure. Titled, Archaeology Confirms 50 Real People in the Bible. The enormous interest this article generated was a complete surprise to me. Nearly 40 websites in 6 languages reflected a wide spectrum of secular and religious orientations linked to Barr's supplementary webpage. So I guess Barr must be the biblical archaeology, I guess. Some even posted translations. I, the author, thought about following up with a similar article on people in the New Testament, but I soon realized that this would be so dominated by the question of Jesus' existence that I needed to consider this question separately. This is that article. Did Jesus of Nazareth, who was called Christ, exist as a human being? The man Christ Jesus, according to 1 Timothy 2:5. The sources normally discussed fall into 3 main categories. Classical, that is Greco-Roman, 2, Jewish, and 3, Christian. When people ask whether it is possible to prove that Jesus of Nazareth actually existed, as John P. Meyer pointed out decades ago, the implication is that the biblical evidence for Jesus is biased because it is encased in a theological text written by committed believers. What they really want to know is there extra biblical evidence for Jesus' existence? Therefore, this article will cover classical and Jewish writings almost exclusively. In the free ebook, and I think I'm going to pick this up, Who Was Jesus? Exploring the history of Jesus' life. Okay, so we get into the historians of that time period. Tacitus, or more formally Gaius or Publius, Cornelius Tacitus, 55 to 56, or 55 or 56 CE, Common Era, to 118, was a Roman senator, orator, and ethnographer, and arguably the best of Roman historians. His name is based on the Latin word tacitus, means silent, from which we get the English word tacit. Interestingly, his compact prose uses silence and implications in a masterful way. One argument for the authenticity of the quotation below is that it is written in true Tacitian Latin. But first, a short introduction. Tacitus' last major work, titled Annals, written roughly 116 to 117 CE, includes a biography of Nero. In 64 CE, during a fire in Rome, Nero was suspected of secretly ordering the burning, false flag, of a part of town where he wanted to carry out a building project. So he tried to shift the blame to Christians. This was the occasion for Tacitus to mention Christians whom he despised. This is what he wrote. The following excerpt is translated from Latin by Robert Van Voorst. Quote, "Neither human effort nor the emperor's generosity nor the placating of the gods ended the scandalous belief that the fire had been ordered by Nero. Therefore, to put down the rumor, Nero substituted as culprits and punished in the most unusual ways those hated for the shameful acts, whom the crowd called Christians. The founder of this name, Christ, Christus in Latin, had been executed in the reign of Tiberius by procurator Pontius Pilate." Thank you very much. "Suppressed for a time, the deadly superstition erupted again not only in Judea, the origin of this evil, but also in the city of Rome, where all things horrible and shameful from everywhere come together and become popular." Excuse me. Tacitus' terse statement about Christus clearly corroborates the New Testament on certain historical details of Jesus' death. Tacitus, or is it Tacitus, presents four pieces of accurate knowledge about Jesus. One, Christus, used by Tacitus to refer to Jesus, was one distinctive way by which one referred to him, even though Tacitus mistakenly took it for a personal name rather than an epithet or title. Number two, this Christus was associated with the beginning of the movement of Christians whose name originated from his. Three, he was executed by the Roman governor of Judea. And four, the time of his death was during Pontius Pilate's governorship of Judea during the reign of Tiberius. And I'm adding this part, the Gospel of Luke is extremely accurate on this particular passage in this article. Many New Testament scholars date Jesus' death to be roughly 29 CE. Pilate governed Judea between 26 to 36 CE, while Tiberius was emperor from 14 to 37 CE. Tacitus, like classical authors in general, does not reveal the source or sources he used. But this should not detract from our confidence in Tacitus' assertions. Scholars generally disagree about what his sources were. Tacitus was certainly among Rome's best historians, arguably the best of all, at the top of his game as a historian and never given to careless writing. Tacitus was also proconsul of Asia. So the man was, he had great credibility and he was a man of distinction. So Tacitus stood a very good chance of becoming aware of information that he characteristically would have wanted to verify before accepting it as true and writing about it. Now, the strong evidence that speaks directly about Jesus as a real person comes from Josephus, a Jewish priest who grew up as an aristocrat in first century Palestine, which, by the way, it's really the province of Syria, Palestine, a province of the Roman Empire. It was never an independent nation, just to be clear. And Josephus ended up living in Rome, supported by the patronage of three successive emperors. In the early days of the first Jewish revolt against Rome, 66 to 70, Josephus was a commander in Galilee, but soon surrendered and became prisoner of war. He then prophesied that his conqueror, the Roman commander Vespasian, would become emperor. And when this actually happened, Vespasian freed him. Quote, "From then on, Josephus lived in Rome under the protection of the Flavians and there composed his historical and apologetic writings." This looks like Gerd, Thasen, and Annette Mertz. Oh, I guess those are the references for this particular part. He even took the name Flavius after the family name of his patron, the Emperor Vespasian, and set it before his birth name, becoming in true Roman style Flavius Josephus. Most Jews viewed him as a despicable traitor. It was by command of Vespasian's son Titus that a Roman army in 70 CE destroyed Jerusalem and burned the temple, sealing its contents as a spoils of war, which are partly portrayed in the imagery of the gloating triumph on the Ark of Titus in Rome. After Rome succeeded his father as emperor, Josephus accepted the son's imperial patronage, as did of Titus's brother and successor, Domitian. Yet in his own mind, Josephus remained a Jew, both in his outlook and in his writings that extol Judaism. At the same time, by aligning himself with Roman emperors who were at that time the worst enemies of the Jewish people, he chose to ignore Jewish popular opinion. So let's scroll down a little bit. In his two great works, The Jewish War and Jewish Antiquities, both written in Greek for educated people, Josephus tried to appeal to aristocrats in the Roman world, presenting Judaism as a religion to be admired for its moral and philosophical depth. The Jewish War doesn't mention Jesus except in some versions and likely later editions by others, but Jewish Antiquities does mention Jesus twice. The shorter of these two references to Jesus in Book 20 is incidental in identifying Jesus' brother James, the leader of the church in Jerusalem, who also wrote in the New Testament the letter of James. In the temporary absence of a Roman governor between Festus' death and Governor Albinus' arrival in 62 CE, the high priest Ananus instigated James' execution. Josephus described it, quote, "Being therefore this kind of person, a heartless Sadducee, Ananus, thinking that he had a favorable opportunity because Festus had died and Albinus was still on his way, called a meeting, literally Sanhedrin, of judges and brought into the brother of Jesus, who is called Messiah, James by name and others. He made the accusation that they had transgressed the law and handed them over to be stoned. James is otherwise barely noticed, minor figure in Josephus' lengthy tome. The sole reason for referring to James at all was that his death resulted in Ananus losing his position as high priest. James, or Jacob, was a common Jewish name at this time. Many men named James are mentioned in Josephus' works." So Josephus needed to specify which one he meant. The common custom of simply giving the father's name James, son of Joseph, would not work here, because James's father's name was also very common. Therefore, Josephus identified this James's father, this James, by reference to his famous brother Jesus. But James' brother Jesus and Yeshua in the Hebrew also had a very common name. Josephus mentions at least 12 other men named Jesus. Therefore, Josephus specified which Jesus he was referring to by adding the phrase, "who is called Messiah," or, since he was writing in Greek, Christos. This phrase was necessary to identify clearly first Jesus and via Jesus, James, the subject of the discussion. This extraneous reference to Jesus would have made no sense if Jesus had not been a real person. Okay? So, I want to scroll down a little bit and I want to get to the third one. So, I'm going to scroll down here. The bold affirmation of Jesus as Messiah reads as a resounding Christian confession that echoes St. Peter himself. Regarding alternative two, the whole testimonial flavium is hypothetically possible. Now, see, this is someone that's trying to do a counter-argument. But again, the counter argument just isn't going to work, because again, Flavius, Josephus, and Tacitus were very credible historians. So, few scholars have ever doubted the authenticity of this short account. In the contrary, the huge majority accept it as genuine. The phrase intended to specify which Jesus translated who was called Christ signifies either that he was mentioned earlier in the book or that readers knew him well enough to grasp the reference to him in identifying James. First century Romans generally had little or no idea who Christus was. It was much more likely that he was mentioned earlier in Jewish antiquities. Also, the fact that the term Messiah, Christ, is not identified here suggests that an earlier passage in Jewish antiquities has already mentioned something of his significance. This phrase is also appropriate for a Jewish historian like Josephus because the reference to Jesus is a non-committal, neutral statement about some people called Jesus and not a confession of faith that actually asserts that he was Christ. So, these are historical references outside of the Bible that confirms that Jesus existed. James, Peter, Paul, and as the top of the article said, that the writer has archaeological evidence and historical evidence of at least 50 characters of the New Testament. So, you know, and again, it's just an abject refusal to believe what clearly multiple sources of evidence reveals. So, when Elohim, at the time, was discussing what Lucifer did to men and women, God prevented man from becoming like one of us. He was speaking to Jesus and his heavenly court. So, that, I think, slams the lid on that deal. So, let's move on to the religion of peace was really busy over the weekend. And so, why don't we rattle off what took place? Let's go to Friday. We've got two instances on Friday. Kolofata, Cameroon, 11 killed, 30 injured. 11 are left dead, and when Islamists strap two girls with bombs and send them into a refugee camp. And this is what they do. They use men and women. To commit these attacks. And they also hide in residential areas. So that to give the false propaganda that the good guys are killing civilians, which is an unavoidable situation considering the modus operandi of these savages. Sidi Bouzid, Tunisia, one was killed. A young shepherd is kidnapped and beheaded by Islamic, well, they use the term extremists. I'm going to say fundamentalists because, look, a behavior is no longer extreme when it's being done for 1,400 years. Okay? So, June 3rd was very, very busy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 instances in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Iraq, London, England. 3 Muslims shouting, "This is for Allah," plow into pedestrians on London Bridge. Then proceeded to a market, stabbing people until 7 others were dead. So you take away the guns, but we'll use knives. Okay, fine. We also had killings in India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Iraq, England, Iraq, and the Philippines. So a total of 9, 52, 54, 56, 76. 76 people were killed, and over 140 people were injured. And basically, 2 people were killed for adultery, alleged adultery by the woman's brother-in-law. Mujahideen members ambushed and killed 2 local security personnel. 43 civilians were massacred by Islamic State as they attempted to flee the caliphate. Again, the London City, 4 suicide bombers were used. A 70-year-old man is picked off by an Islamic sniper. And then we have yesterday, that was busy too. 9 people were killed, 1 were injured. This is Afghanistan, Pakistan, 2 in Pakistan. An 18-year-old girl is shot to death by her father for having an affair. So we have these honor killing deals. 2 Hazara religious minorities are gunned down for their faith. Of course they are. 2 religious men join the police and then gun down 6 colleagues in cold blood. So I guess the Muslim police get to kill people over the religion of peace. So 2 heads of state speak out about the so-called extreme terrorism, which is nothing more than a fundamental worldwide jihad. It is the second major jihad, and they've been able to pull this off because the West has been financing these people for decades, and I could get into the whys and wheres and hows, and I will at some point, but certainly not today. So Donald Trump says, this bloodshed must end. Well, that's overstating the obvious, isn't it? Sure, it must end. Theresa May says that this evil ideology must be stopped. Yes, this evil ideology must be stopped. But you see, both say that this behavior must discontinue. But they refuse to tell you how it's going to be stopped. See, they don't want to give you that answer. They can't give you that answer because they don't have the strength and the wherewithal to carry out what must be done. I'm going to tell you what must be done, and then I'm going to close the show with Black Sabbath, sung by Rodney James Dio, Heaven and Hell, which everyone needs to make a decision. Will they align themselves to the cross, or will they align themselves to the other general, which is Lucifer? You must make that decision. But what has to be, you want to end the bloodshed? You want to end the evil ideology? President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Theresa May, you must renounce and ban and outlaw the satanic cultish ideology known as Islam. You must drive out every Muslim. I don't care what the citizenship is, and I don't care how nice and huggy and kissy they've been. And I'll just revert back to San Bernardino. Thank you very much. And they must be driven back to where they came from. And then they must be contained. And the Muslim countries of the world that are 60% or more, Muslim majorities that, well, believe in Sharia law, like Turkey and Saudi Arabia, all funding, all business transactions, and all alliances must be cut off immediately. In other words, cut the money. When the money runs out, these terrorist cells can no longer operate. And then, those Muslim countries in the Middle East and North Africa, and yes, the Asian continent, will have to make a decision. Either stay Islamic and starve to death, or renounce and outlaw this cultish ideology known as Islam the way the West just did, should they choose to do so. That's the solution, folks. You either side with the cross or you do not. That's it. We can debate and we can argue and we can go back and forth, or we can just accept reality. You either pick up your cross or you go on the other side. I have chosen to wear my cross around my neck and wear it loud and proud wherever I go, and you must make your decision. So I call on the leaders of the world to accept reality, and if you're sincere that this has to end, you have to make it end. And what I've given you is the only realistic solution, because everything else is not going to work, I promise you. So let's end the show with Black Sabbath, Heaven and Hell. My name is Michael B. This is the Truth Zone, deep within the information revolution. We'll be back 10 a.m. Texas time.